Stay tuned for an engaging conversation with art writer John Seed. John is the author of Disrupted Realism, Paintings for a Distracted World, and the newly published More Disruption, Representational Art in Flux. I'm looking forward to my copy arriving soon. Welcome to Art Ladders, The Creative Climb with Valerie Allen and Armin Merzman. This podcast is focused on interviews, features, and stories about art. It's for artists and art lovers. I'm Val. I'm the abstract artist in the group, joined by Armin, the realist. Hello, everyone, and I'm so happy to have you back here for episode 59. Today, we have a special episode with John Seed, author and artist. But first, I'd like to say hi to Armin out there. Hi, Armin. How are you doing?
Going great today. I'm also excited to see what John has to say, and I'm very familiar with his books and what he says about art. It's fascinating. It's quite an honor to have you on our little podcast, John.
It sure
Thanks for having me, of course.
Yes. So I first became aware of John in 2020, and it was during a video episode interview with Nicholas Wilton, and it was a fabulous interview. It was an hour, and it was all video, and it was showing your Disrupted Realism book. And I and Armin brought it to his attention. We just started following you along after all of that and kept up with you. And then recently you had another interview with Nicholas, and it was just wonderful as well. So for the audience out there, John is an artist and an author. And whoops, I just dropped something. That's part of a Zoom, I guess. Artist and an author. And he's a retired professor living on the Central Coast of California. And as an artist educator, he has taught everything from studio art, art history, theory, and one of my interests to learn more about, art criticism. He's done all of that. He is a blogger, and he's written for folks like Huffington Post, Hyperallergic, which I'm a fan of as well, and Art LTD. So we are excited to jump into this interview, and I'm going to do what I usually do, where I ask a little bit about young life of young John Seed, and what were the first thoughts you had as a child that this might be the route you're going, if at all. So,
well, thank you. And just first of all, again, thank you again, Val and Armin, for taking an interest in what I do. I'm honored to be part of your podcast and hope to not disappoint. Usually once I get going, if I've slept well and had my coffee, you'll get a pretty good podcast. And I think that's the case today. So I'll see what I can do for you.
That's great.
Okay. Well, you know, my early life, I'll tell you something I've been thinking about recently. I think that something that really defined my early life and the life of my peers is we came after Vietnam.
Yes.
Had I been a few years older, I would have had to have a draft card. But timing is important in life. And I grew up, I think, taking in some of the positives and the best parts that came out of the 60s and flowed into the early 70s.
Were you born, one of them,
I was born in 1957.
Yeah.
So cars still had tail fins, you know, a few fins out there.
Five, I was born. So, yeah, I went through kind of the same kind of thing with Vietnam and all that. So we're a little closer. I'm a little older. We're close to the same age.
You were a little closer to all of the, you know, the turmoil and the difficulty and all of that. But I just was, my mother tells people I was the reasonable child. I was, you know, creative early. And I remember maybe being 5 or 6 years old and drawing Woody Woodpecker for my dad when he came home from work. And we had a workshop behind our house. My parents added on to the back of the garage. And my dad had a lot of tools that had come from his grandfather, his father. His father had been an aviation machinist. And then my dad liked woodworking. And so I tell people I had a hands-on childhood, building model airplanes, working on bicycles when I got older. And I had a business doing puppet shows at kids' birthday parties with my friends Lenny and Sean. And we made extra money. And that was also just another part of the creativity that I really felt growing up.
Oh, that is so wonderful. I love that puppet show idea because I was told when I was younger that that's right when the movie portable movie cameras came out, and I would direct all my cousins in these little crazy home movies. So it reminds me of your puppet show adventures. So.
Well, and it came in handy in a very peculiar way, maybe not a peculiar way, maybe a great way. And that is that later when I began teaching, I was very at ease speaking in public. And I realized it went all the way back to being at some, 8-year-old's birthday party with puppets on my arms, holding them up over the stage, because you learn to be funny because kids are a tough audience. And also, if you're a little bit shy, you're behind the stage, just like I'm hidden from the viewers right now. They're not seeing the video. And with a little bit of being hidden and talking through a character as an alter ego, you learn public speaking. And it served me
He
very, very
actually has
well as a
puppets on
college
at this
professor.
speed.
Yeah.
You should have put your puppets on, Jack.
Well, I heard Jim Henson speak once before he
Did
died. I
you?
heard him speak in public. And he told the audience, he said, "I'm not a funny man unless I put on a puppet." And to prove it, he put on Kermit. And you could see the transformation. He was funny when he put on the
Yeah.
puppet. So I related to that.
Kind of an alter ego.
That is interesting. Yeah. And that maker background too is very important for artists. And so you had, the machine shop, like a wood shop with machines back there to tinker around with. That is very, very similar to a background I had as well, in about that same time period. I often think of myself more as a maker than an artist, and I think a lot of artists do feel that way. So, yeah, I listened to one of your interviews, and I love the title of this interview. It was called The Non-Tragic Backstory, and you're alluding
Right,
to
right.
that idyllic childhood, with your resources right there and family right there. And you talked a lot about your teachers and mentors in that episode. Tell us about some of your mentors.
Well, there were many, because I had many great teachers. And I grew up in an era when we had wonderful public schools. One small example, Mrs. Sussman, my sixth grade teacher, had us do a mural of the Taj Mahal on the wall of her classroom. And I remember being kind of the second or third in line of the class artists. There was a young man named Spencer Nilsson that was much better than I was. And so it was an experience of wanting to compete with Spencer, and that kind of upped my game a little bit. But I would say, in terms of maybe when the mentors really began to make a tremendous impact, it was when I got to college. And to set the stage, I got to Stanford, and that was the family school. My grandfather had actually gone there before they charged tuition, class of 1919. And so, of course, my family had all kinds of expectations. Well, John's going to Stanford, and he's going to be a attorney or a doctor, or he's going to be some kind of high-end professional. And I kind of wandered around my first year not finding myself, until I took a class with Nathan Oliveira, who was a printmaker and painter in the Bay Area. And without saying too much about that, because I could go on for hours about Nathan, but I'll just say it was an epiphany. I knew exactly what I wanted to do after taking his class. And I came home and said, "Mom and Dad, I have the best news. I have the most exciting news. I want to be a painter and I want to be a teacher." And of course, they were flabbergasted, because that's the last, I'm a parent now. That's you don't tell your kids go into art. That's a very, very tough field. And really, kind of everybody that knew me well and everybody that cared about me in one way or another just said, "Whatever field you go into, don't go into that one. Don't go into art, whatever you do." But of course, I did. I had to, because the field had really found me.
It sure did. That's so true. my son ended up going into medicine. I don't know what I would have done if he said he was going into art, but isn't it funny how it's almost the opposite? You know, my parents wanted me to go into teaching art. Well, they knew I was going into art, so that was a given, but then they really wanted me to go into teaching, but I resisted that as well and went into just the fine art, studio art all the way. But of course, here I am now, art educator, and loving that portion of it. So,
well, Armin, we're all born with our own agendas, right?
Oh, yeah. Our own timing. Yes, that's right. That's right. So
my dad was an artist, so
yeah.
He
wanted you to be an artist.
He was my mentor. We immigrated from Germany when I was 7.
I'm holding this up.
I've got a question for Armin while you hold up the book. I mean, did you ever feel some resistance that maybe that you wanted to be different from your father? Any rebellion in there?
Not with the art. It felt like that's what I'm going to be. I didn't really think about it. I wanted to be a veterinarian for about 5 minutes, but that took a lot of college.
Right.
And it's something I did, you know, as a kid, like you said, you know, I went to school and, oh no, have Armin do the artwork. Just don't let him spell anything. That's kind of what that was about. So no, I never really gave it much thought. I did make a decision though that I didn't want to live off my art, because that would make me change and think about saleability. I didn't want to think that.
That's a good decision. Yeah, I respect that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, we've been lucky that way, and that we can make a living in the field of art, but not so much having to have our paintings and drawings ready to sell. It's the teaching and the mentoring and things like that we can do. And so, and as far as mentoring and teaching, when I look through your book, Disrupted Realism, that's the current book you have out, and we'll talk about the new book that's coming out in just a few days, really. But
of course,
when I read that one, I highly recommend folks reading that. You learn. So it's like, I'm not going to call it a textbook, because it's much more interesting than any textbook I've ever read, or even any art history book, to tell you the truth. It's you interviewing the artists and really getting their take on their deep gut level of art making. There's so much to be learned from the book. And I'm curious on a couple of things. One, where you found the artists, how you found them. And two, how did you come up with those wonderful questions for them?
Well, this is a part where, and you know, just give me the signal across the screen if I go too long, but I'd like to give you a little depth here and tell the story that really leads up to the book, because
it
took a long time to get to the point that I could assemble a proper book and do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, what are the major pieces in my journey? Well, let's just say that at age 28, I found myself teaching at a community college.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, very, very fortunate to get a full-time job. I moved away from the city where I'd grown up. I moved to kind of a rural area called Hemet, San Jacinto, and started my career in this small town. And when you teach at a community college, it's an incredible situation in terms of making you a better teacher fast. Because at a community college, you have every age range. I had teenagers, I had people in their 70s. Mm-hmm. You have students that are very accomplished and even brilliant, and you have students that don't want to be there, that are struggling, mm-hmm. that have been forced by their parents, you know, to be in community college, and you have everything in between. And your job as a teacher is that you want to somehow excite the more capable students and keep them involved, but you also want to reach the students that think they can't be reached. You know, I call them the back row, which is often where they were. So I taught, you know, both studio art and art history at the community college for about 15 years. I'm going to say in the first phase of my career, where every morning at 9 o'clock, I'd have an art history class. And I just learned to be clear in speaking about art, because I had to be. That was my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the class every time that I taught the class. That's one way of looking at it. I reread the textbooks myself. and I graded the papers and I changed the essay topic. So there was really a long period for me as a young man of I was educating myself both to be a teacher and looking hard at the whole topic of art history and of just absorbing it time and time again. And then I came to a break in my life. I'm sure you both know sometimes life is the unexpected. How do you react to something that you had no idea was coming? But around 2001, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had testicular cancer, which came on very, very rapidly, very close to what Lance Armstrong had, if you've heard about his
Oh, yes.
story or read his book. And so I had a real medical emergency and I needed chemotherapy. And at the same time, I went through a divorce because this is a tremendous strain on a family when someone is ill that way. So I went from this period of growth and stability and becoming a teacher to a real crisis, and then came out of it, thanks to great doctors, came out of it with full remission, but a little bit of a different perspective. And before I had started my cancer treatment, I had written a magazine article about an artist. It was the first time I'd really, tried writing and having something published. And after I was done with chemo, I got a phone call that I had won a professional journalist award in art writing for my magazine article.
Wow, that's
And
amazing.
it hit me, kind of like you feel, this is a new phase of life. I thought, I'm going to keep a few paintings going in the garage, but maybe it's really time to give attention to writing. Maybe that's really where my place in art is going to be because this is a signal to try it. And a couple years later, I decided it would be good to be an art critic. That was the traditional thing to do. And I contacted a nearby paper and they said, great, we don't have an art critic. You can do this and we'll pay you $50 and here's the show you should review. And it was really it was a joke. It was a disaster. I sent in my review. I didn't hear back from the editor. I didn't hear back. When I finally did, he had taken what I thought was a really nicely written review and he had cut half of it out. He'd made it bullet points and he gave it a cute title that had a pun in it so people would read it.
Oh boy.
And
No.
I thought, that's it. Nope, no art critic for me. And I told them to keep their $50. And I told them if they took my name off it, they could publish it. But I just felt like that was a fail. That's not going to work. And newspapers were beginning to struggle, by the way, at this point with the internet. That was part of the background of this. So when that happened, I complained about it and I complained on Facebook. I had just joined Facebook and a well-known art writer in California named Peter Frank was on my Facebook and he said, well, the Huffington Post is starting an all arts section that's going to be all online and I can get you a blog on the Huffington Post. And that was magic. So it came from something that went wrong and it turned into something terrific. And over the next 7 years, from 2010 to 2017, I wrote roughly a blog a week, which added up to maybe over 350 blogs for the Huffington Post, all about art and artists. And I found my voice as a writer. I found that I had more to say than I thought I was going to say. And this is where we are getting to the book, by the way. I haven't forgotten that we're
Oh,
talking about the
I
book.
love hearing all this.
But I interviewed over 150 artists.
Wow.
How
Amazing.
did you choose your artist, John?
Probably the way you do at Art Ladders for your podcast. And I bet it's similar. Whenever I would write about somebody, I tended to make a friend, just as we're going to come away from this friends, unless I say something awful by accident, But you make a friend, and then people would email me later, well, John, I so enjoyed being interviewed by you. You should interview my friend so and so. And it was like a game of tag. I just kept meeting people. And it became the friends of my friend's friends. And I formed an understanding of really a kind of a group of artists and their associates. And it was those artists where I began to notice some of the type of art that ended up being in the book that ended up being in Disrupted Realism. And specifically at the very, very end of my blogging career, maybe, a year before I was done, I wrote a blog that I called it Discombobulation in Art. I didn't call it disruption yet. I called it discombobulation. And I borrowed that from a friend. I want to credit my friend F. Scott Hess, who used that word when he talked about motion in art. And I wrote a blog. And then I got another chain reaction from that because a gallery associate in Philadelphia, read it online, and told her boss, told the gallery owner, Catherine Stanek, this is good. This would make a really good exhibition. So they contacted me, and that made the first disrupted realism group show in Philadelphia at the Stanek Gallery. But then a publisher's representative saw the show and went home to the home office and told her publisher, this would make a good book.
Wow.
So the blog led to the show, which led to the book, which in turn led to the second book. So it's all out of this chain reaction, just going back to the beginning of having the shot to blog for the Huffington Post.
Wow.
How did that word disrupted realism, is that something that you have coined, or has it, you know, I mean, in some ways it's been around for a while, but without the emphasis that's being put on it now, I think.
Well, it came from a little, I'm going to call it a gentle and friendly discussion or even argument, because I had written this blog and I'd used the word discombobulated. And when it came time to put together the show, that word was still out there. And I know you work with a lot of artists, and you're artists yourselves. Artists are sensitive about the language you use with them.
Yes.
And one of the artists in the book contacted Catherine Stanek, and he said, with all, you know, respect to John, I don't want my kids to know me as the guy who discombobulated. You know, he said, I don't like that word. It sounds confusing. It doesn't sound right. And I said, understood. So I had a dialogue with him. I had a dialogue with Catherine Stanek. I had a list of titles. You know, I worked on it for a while. But eventually it boiled down to disrupted realism, because I wanted to say, first of all, that, you know, that realism was an ingredient that was a part of the training of these artists. But I wanted to say that something had happened to it, that it had changed. And disrupted was the very, very best word to describe the fact that, you know, the way things came together, there'd been a glitch. There'd been a change. There'd been an opening for something different. And so I would say maybe 90% of the artists in the book liked that word disrupted. A few don't, so they don't use it, which is fine with me. But it's what's out there now. And it's what, you know, I'm sure people, when they hear my name, they say, oh, there's the disruption guy. I know that these things kind of stay with you.
I really like that title, and because the word disrupted for me, and this kind of comes from the entrepreneurial world, is when a business does something that's so out of extraordinary that it changes things coming on down the line. So that's how I'm looking at disrupted realism.
And it's both positive and it's negative.
Right.
You know, if you're a Buddhist, you say, oh, well, that's the possibility when you know, you can do things that are new.
Yes.
But if you're a person that likes order and perfection, you say, well, that's where it all goes to hell.
Right.
And it really means both things.
It does mean both things. Yeah. It's a great word. And I also, you talked about how you found your leads and, you know, going from artist and another artist introduces. It's so true. We've found this in the podcast, just like you said, that we do. And it's why we do these things. It's why, you know, we have a podcast. It's why you were a blogger. Bloggers have those kinds of possibilities, and you've proved it. People see that out there. You don't know who sees it. And then you get these wonderful opportunities. News travels fast. It really does.
I'm very aware. I'm sure your listeners are. I'm aware of the problems with the internet and the problems with social media.
Yeah.
I mean, many serious problems have been created, but I've also lived the upside. And one of the reasons it was so wonderful to become a blogger when I did is that, having grown up in the city and then moved to a small town, I felt isolated.
Right.
And suddenly I was having all these, you know, kind of conversations and interactions with people I wanted to be in touch with through writing. So the social side of podcasting, writing, making art in conversation with others, I mean, it's really, really powerful. And both of the books, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to write either of these books without social media. My new book is almost entirely curated on Instagram. And that was maybe before Instagram got so full of reels and nonsense like it has in the last year. But I've really used social media. And one more thing about it. I began to understand working for the Huffington Post that traditional newspaper art writers or critics would get assignments. An editor would say, go down to this gallery or this museum and review this show, and you have 6 column inches and you have one photo. They had very strict requirements. I would wake up in the morning and think, who would I like to write about? Or what would I like to see? And I would submit it. And at the Huffington Post, as my editor used to say, if it's not actionable, we'll post it. So I was able to make my own choices. And that included, eventually, I interviewed some artists, you know, in Europe, all over the United States. So I had a broader look at art because of the breadth of being an internet-based art writer and not a local critic.
Also able to, you know, if you were doing this 40 years ago, you'd have to live in New York or you'd have to live in LA. Now, you know, there's so many people in the world that you could possibly interview if it interests you. Now, that's both good and bad, too, as you said, social media is. But, you know, I find it, you know, when I was a kid and, you know, my dad would take me to an art museum and I saw his work. That was my world. That was my art world. You know, we didn't go to a gallery very much unless my dad was in it. But, you know, now you can look almost at too much. You miss stuff because there's so much art out there. You might miss a real gem just because you're just going through it. What do you think?
Well, that's an issue. I mean, I tell people, and I say this with a sense of humor, but I think it's true. We're all curators now.
Yeah,
because we all have to decide what's worth our time and what's worth looking at, because we face a glut. We're looking at way too much.
It's like going to a museum. I have about 2 hours, or I'll start walking by a Rembrandt and Picasso, and they start looking alike to me. You know, so I got about 2 hours of concentration in me. It's the same with the internet. You see so much of it. I like to see a little bit of it, and I will do my own thing. Yeah. It's just overload.
Well, and you won't maybe notice this because you're only spending an hour with me today, but I tell my friends I have the attention span of a 9-year-old boy. And it's true. That's absolutely true. So, I have to curate. I have to be careful how I spend my time and keep taking myself into new things so I don't get bored, because I get bored pretty quickly.
Oh yeah. And like you said, we see so much. I get on that crazy Instagram and I love it. I love looking at imagery, and that keeps me not as bored, but it does waste a lot of time. So you're right. It's good to mix it up a little bit.
You see things on your monitor, everything's the same size. You can't see texture. Photorealism becomes even more photorealism because you can't walk up to it. Val had a show recently and people started watching. Oh, I couldn't believe how big these pieces were because they were so used to seeing
they're
them.
Seeing them little squares.
Yeah, everything's the same size. What do you think about that?
This brings back, Val, did I cut you off?
Oh, no, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay, this brings back, having produced now 2 books, I've learned a few things about books in this situation, in the situation where we have the internet and too much imagery. You know, people will tell you that maybe books are going away, you know, or they're less important, they have less of an impact. I'm finding that these art books have a tremendous impact. And it's actually because of the situation that you and Armin have been describing. And what happens in a book, the 2 books, The Disrupted Realism and More Disruption, the designer just knocks herself out to make sure we get the highest resolution images. And they are incredibly well printed. And you get it all between 2 covers. And it's a slower experience in the book. You know, that scrolling you tend to do when you're on your laptop or something, it slows down quite a bit. And I think of these books as a group show with no shipping charges, right? Because you can have an artist from New York and one from London and one from Israel, no shipping charges.
Yep.
And then a slower pace of looking because of the quality of the printing and the singularity. You know, I've done the curation of the images for you. So you're not scrolling left and right, you know, to see what you're getting. And I'm actually finding that people really respond to the books almost more than ever just because of the glut of internet images that we're all looking through.
And you're right. It does slow you down quite a bit. I was watching the trailer for More Disruption, and beautiful trailer, by the way. And there was an artist in there, and his name is, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Rupert von Kaufman.
Yes.
And that image just it fit my taste, it fit my aesthetic. I just was fascinated. In disrupted realism, it's pretty much figurative portraiture. Would you say that particular
It's nearly all
just
figuration, and you're right, a
yes.
great deal of portraits, right? Great, a great number.
And it seems in this trailer for the new book, it branches out, gets a little more landscape oriented a little bit, but very narrative, very storytelling. And the story on that with the people in the boat on that particular painting, it just seems so timely. And I just want to know more about the artist, more about the story they're telling. And it also was teaching me a lesson on, how do you create art in difficult times? And a lot of that imagery in that trailer kind of pushed those buttons on me. Because I think artists, sometimes when we're doing our artwork, and maybe I'm talking about just myself, but Armin, you chime in if you feel this way. When a very difficult world is going on, to create art at that time, how do we tell our stories and not feel like we're being, kind of vain or being self-absorbed? But the artwork in that trailer just seemed to hit the sign of the times for me. Any thoughts on
Well,
how artists can
my
come?
thoughts are, as an artist, I got to talk about the way I see the world and I perceive the world treating me. And yes, it might not be obvious, but there's always some kind of social narrative kind of going on in there, even though it's not shock art or something like that. But my mom used to say to me, she had this German accent, "Ami, why don't you do something pretty?" I said, "Well, to me, this is important. It's important to say. And things happening in the world today is not often pretty." So I guess that's all I want to say without taking over here in this conversation. But, I need to really speak about what I say. I need to really be honest. And that doesn't mean it can't be a beautiful piece.
No, Armin, I think that's wise, and there's maybe a paradox. When you brought up maybe, self-absorption, and I have someone in mind. I'm not going to use their name, but I'll tell you about someone that was, one of my mentors. I remember had a teacher who I thought, both in his art and in his steps himself, when I met him, I thought, well, he's very self-absorbed, so into this imaginative world and forgetful in class and just all in this art world, to such a high degree. But then I also noticed that when I spoke with him and he was out of that, when he turned his attention on me, his ability to understand what I was thinking and what I needed and how I could be a better artist was remarkable. And I realized it went hand on hand, your self-understanding. And I'm not talking about narcissism. I'm not talking about you become brittle and all about yourself, but I'm talking about your self-understanding can help you deepen your understanding and your empathy with others. And that's why art is such a great conversation. And I think that those of us, if we've got the luxury, we have time in a studio with our blank canvas or our media, thinking about what we want to create, we are able to heal ourselves quite a bit, to reconcile ourselves with the world. And then we bring that back to the world. And in that difficult world, the challenging world, the world of disruptions, if you will, if we can bring greater centeredness and sanity back to that, and we can understand others better, then I see a very valid and very powerful role for art.
Yeah, I agree.
You juried a show in Flint, Michigan. I
I
don't
did.
know, at the Buckham Gallery. I don't know if that was all an online jury process for you or if you actually came into our area. But what did you think? That would be probably a draw from that Midwestern crowd of artists. Any thoughts you'd like to share about the imagery that you were coming through from mid United States, the flyover state?
Well, yeah, first of all, that was done online. And
Okay.
my co-juror was Ann Harris, who's a wonderful artist in Chicago. That's
Okay.
Ann with an E, by the way, if you look her up.
Yes.
And but we did online jurying.
Uh-huh.
And thinking back to that, because that was maybe a couple of years ago,
I think so.
I was, first of all, the artwork was really maybe better than expected. That's one thing.
Good.
There were a lot of very fine and interesting painters. But I'm also going to say that there was more troubled art than I had expected. All kinds of art that indicated personal traumas and struggles and, difficult things, the kind of subject matter that would have gone into German Expressionism, in the
Yes.
1930s, but showing up in American art, North American art here
Interesting.
in the 2020s. And that was, I think, I'm trying to think if that show was before COVID. I believe it was before COVID. And then, COVID hit. But that's my
Could have been.
recollection of what I saw. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that because I curated a show that's going to open up in December at the Buckham Gallery called Four Realists, Four Voices. And it's people that I've been dealing on and off with realists. Robert Sheffman's a big name. And of course, I'm going to curate a show. I'm putting myself in. That's just the kind of guy I am. But it's exciting about that the show, that it's a different view on realism and how I personally got, as a realist, how I got tired of realism at some point, too.
So more disruption is coming out October 28th. I already have it pre-ordered, of course. But, I'm going to put that in the show notes, how we get a hold of that particular book. And that's going to be an easy fix so that people can go ahead and order that, pre-order it. I'm looking forward to it so much. Now that you have that completed, are you taking a break? What's your project you're working on now? I'm sure you're always moving ahead with something.
Well, I'll back you up a little bit. I want to say two or three things about that book, and then
You
I'm going to remember
bet.
Your question. What's next question? But
Perfect.
This is the part in the interview where my parents raised me with those values, the don't brag values. So I'm holding back a little bit, but I'm just going to put it out there.
Yes.
I think this book is the best thing I've ever done.
Oh, can't wait.
And I'm 66. I feel like I'm a slow bloomer. Like I said, went through quite a bit in middle age and built myself as a teacher and then found myself as a writer. And I'm proud of the first book. I'm proud of Disrupted Realism. But, it's just like in the studio, every time you do something, the next time you do it, you try to make it a little better. You try to improve
Yes.
it. And this has a little broader selection of artists. I think that the text is a little stronger. And I have a great opener. I was able to get Jenny Seville to give
That's
permission
right.
to put her art. So
That's
there's an
right.
essay dedicated to Jenny Seville, she's influenced so many painters. She's such a powerhouse in the world of
Yes.
art. So this book has some ingredients where I just feel like, wow, I think this really, really turned out. So as far as what's next, maybe this is a little bit surprising, but I feel like I'd like to rest. I'd like to walk the dogs a lot. I'd like to learn some new recipes. I'm going to become a grandfather in April for the first time, so I'd like to really enjoy
Yes.
that and be a granddad. I
Yes.
have three different parties now asking me to do books, and I'm saying no to all of them because that was a lot of work.
That's a
And
lot
it
of
turned out
work.
well. I'd like to breathe that in for
Oh
a
my
while and just
gosh.
feel good
Yes.
about it all. Yeah.
Oh
You
yes.
gotta breathe in
Absolutely.
what you just created,
Yeah, that's right.
There's things like, a book, I know for those of you, I'm thrilled that some of you are going to order it, and I hope you enjoy it. And it probably seems glamorous, but I got to tell you, that last month of checking all the captions and finding out, by the way, Jenny Seville's titles were wrong. We caught that the day before we were going to, finalize the book.
Oh.
And, making sure that the color is adjusted right on the images and all this stuff, it was just, I had my hair standing on end. So there's a lot of work that goes into a book. And what I'm really going to enjoy about October 28th, I'm going to enjoy the, it's out there.
It's
That's
out there.
Done.
It's
brew a coffee,
going to have a
unveiling. Yeah. Celebrate.
Yeah, celebrate. That's where I'm at.
Oh,
is there
boy.
A book unveiling somewhere where you're going to be?
You know what you do now? I did an unboxing video when the publisher sent me a copy. I put my video camera so you couldn't see my face. You just see my hands, and I pull it out, and I unwrap it. And that's apparently the hot thing to do now.
That
and,
is the hot thing.
There will be the Art Ladders podcast and, maybe some other podcasts.
Yeah.
There is going to be, there's later after I rest, there's going to be a show in 2024 at the Oceanside Museum of Art here on the Southern California coast.
Okay.
And it's going to feature two of the artists from the book. It'll feature Aaliyah Chapin and Timothy Robert Smith as kind of the lead artists, the way that Ann Harris was a lead artist at the Buckham Gallery. And they will jury a show around it. So that'll be a, a show that's themed to the book. And, there may be some other things as well, but that's what I've got on the calendar.
Oh, wow. That's wild. That sounds kind of fun. And do they still do book tours where you would go sign copies and all of that?
I kind of don't want that. That's another reason that Zoom is
that's
great,
very
because
busy. Yeah.
We live in a small town. We live in an area that the airport's far away. It's kind of hard to get here. It's inconvenient, and I'm starting to really like it. And, I would like to mainly just stay home and let the book, get mailed out to people and take care of itself. The book tour does not sound all that appealing to me.
Right. How many artists are in the book?
43. Jenny Seville, she's the only artist that doesn't have an interview. She has an essay.
Okay,
and then 42
yes.
artists with that format of them doing an essay. And, I almost forgot. You asked me earlier about the questions.
Oh, I did. Yes.
I have a favorite interview question, and for anybody that for any reason does interviews, I want to recommend this to you.
Okay.
Whatever your scripted interview is, your last question should always be, is there anything else you'd like to mention? Because that's where I got the really interesting things. Like in the first book, I found out, for example, that Justin Bauer got very, very serious about his painting after he was stabbed in downtown Los Angeles.
Oh my God.
And I found out that these are a couple of traumas, but another artist in the first book was hit by a baseball, a foul ball at Dodger Stadium, was an 8-year-old, and had really become an artist out of recovering from a brain injury. An extraordinary story. That's Aiden Kringen is that artist. Catherine Kehoe had been raised by an aunt after her father was arrested as a bank robber, So there were all these, amazing stories, and they really enriched the interviews and made it, I think, a much better read than just a, flat out art book.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like they had a story to tell.
Yes. Oh, I like that.
It might have not been the story about the baseball, but when you go through any kind of trauma, I think you spend a lifetime trying to tell that story through your art in some way. It might not be conscious,
A title of book having disruption in it, it comes up naturally to people say, here's the things in my life where I turned a corner or something changed. And as a cancer survivor, I relate to that. There's a moment where it all seems to be going downhill, and then something changes. So I relate to that.
Yeah.
That I just jogged my memory too. I thought of another question, John, that I emailed you quite recently about, and that's about the online class you're going to teach in January with the Penn University.
Well, no, it's called the Penn Studio School of
that's
Art.
It. Penn Studio.
And since
School
I've got
of
the
Art.
Chance to give a plug, I'll repeat that so people could find it on the internet. Penn with two N's, so P-E-N-N, Penn Studio School. And when you get there, just look at their their winter of 24 classes is where you want to look. Winter of 24. And the class, it's called Art Criticism for Artists. And the theme is that I certainly give people a little bit of art history, the history of criticism, who are some key figures, how did it develop? But then I also try to take it into people's life and art practices in a very practical way, and talk about, first of all, how they can understand and accept art criticism, and then how they might want to do it, how they might want to write about their own work or other people's work. And so it's kind of a, it's really shaped towards artists, but it's a fully online 5-week class. It's taught on Zoom. It's pretty small. I think I had maybe 12 to 15 when I taught it last time around. And we break into Zoom breakout rooms. We have small discussions, and it's very friendly, very friendly class.
Oh, it sounds so interesting. And oh, I'm seriously considering it, because when I work with artists as an educator, they often ask me how they can self-critique their own work. And I feel like your class will give us some insights into things, questions we can ask ourselves. Am I right on that? To kind of...
Oh, you're right about that. And I want to tell you what my friend Peter Zukoski always says. He says, no artist is beyond criticism. And that includes ourselves and includes, you know, every artist we see in the world. And I think having a healthy relationship with criticism, and by the way, by criticism, not meaning, you know, hurtful or, you know, breaking people down or negativity. I'm just saying we educate ourselves and have a real deep dialogue about art and its meanings, and we educate others with our criticism. That has real, real value that we all need, and we all need to explore that.
And it will probably help us too, as we write our artist statements. It would be kind of a lead into that as well.
Oh, we do that as part of the
class. Oh, it's part of the class. Okay.
Yeah. We have something about that. And I have my own take, I think, on what an artist statement should be. Not everybody agrees with me, but we definitely go through that. And it's a practical, friendly, and kind of hands-on class, honestly.
Wonderful. Oh, I'm glad that jumped back into my memory to ask you that before you're out of here, because I'm going to use the question you told me to use. That you use in your interviews, is there anything else you want to tell us? Anything else you want to share?
Well, I like the person behind the art. And when people ask me, John, what are you reading? I always have an artist biography on the bedside table.
Oh, okay.
I read Ai Weiwei's incredible biography with the story of his father in China during the Cultural Revolution. I've been reading, I read Lucian Freud's biography, all of John Richardson's books about Picasso, because to me it's the artist comes alive in the art, and I find biography really, really valuable.
I agree.
Oh, I'm going
to... kind of biography. It doesn't necessarily have to be a fine artist, a musician. Just how did they get that passion? You know, I mean, you and I are both the same age, and when people say, well, who influenced you the most? I said, I have to be honest, it was the Beatles, you know? They made me feel a certain way. And I wanted to make people feel that way through art in a different way, you know, the way I did. And so, you know, I mean, the first time I saw my first Van Gogh, it blew me across the museum. But it was the Beatles and the power of communication and that all that was going on that influenced me to be an artist more so. But my dad was a visual, more so than other visual artists.
So when I taught my middle daughter to drive, we started playing oldies. When I'm doing driving lessons, I played the Beatles for her, turned her on to the Beatles, and that made the driving lessons magical.
I bet.
Yeah, it was great.
That's wonderful. And
today, still music is a very important use for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not stuck in the 70s or 60s. Or, you know.
I think I am. Oh, well, John, this has been a thrill. I'm so looking forward to it. We both were, and that you shared some time with us. And I'll put as much as I can into the show notes. You gave us a lot of resources.
Are you sure you're timing this right?
It feels like
and,
it
you know,
went
one
too
thing
fast.
For the show notes, and then something I'll say too.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in being easy to contact and easy to find. So you'll be shocked at the title of my website. It's johnseed.com.
I'm shocked. No.
And then you know my email address, johnseed@gmail.com, G as in George. So anybody, you have a question from the podcast, or just you want to be in touch and say, you know, that was a lot of hot air, John, or that was inaccurate, or I love what you said, you know, any of those things, send me an email and I'll make sure to get back to you.
Oh, that's very generous. Very generous. And yeah, that you would open that up.
People, I mean,
yeah.
I can put you in the spam filter if there's a problem, but no, it usually oh, no. goes real well.
Problem there.
Well, don't put me in spam, please. Oh. Okay.
Anyway, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, John, and I look forward to your new book and see what you're doing on the horizon. And thank you for doing our podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And I want your comments when you get the new book. Email me and be frank, you know, what you like, what you're not sure about. Send me some good, frank comments and I will relish your feedback.
Okay, you've got it. Thank you. Many thanks to John Seed. Please take him up on his invitation to email him with comments on this episode or on his books. He is a thought leader for visual artists, enthusiastic to talk with you. We are so honored to be sponsored by a wonderful support system for artists with Golden Apple Studio and Residency. Take a listen to their mission statement. To provide dedicated time and space in which artists and writers may pursue their work within a unique community whose singular purpose is to inspire, support, and honor excellence and creativity. Director Shelley Stevens is a dedicated practicing artist, and she understands how important a residency can be for an artist. Many past residents have personally expressed that they have had many artistic breakthroughs or ha-ha moments during their time at Golden Apple Residencies. With the nurturing and peaceful atmosphere of living on the Atlantic Ocean in Maine for 2 weeks, artists are set up for success during those weeks. We encourage you to start a discussion with Shelley Stevens by email at snstevens@goldenapplestudio.com or learn more and be sure to check out goldenapplestudio.com and their Facebook page. Thank you so much, Shelley. Thank you for listening. You can find our past and future episodes at anchor.fm, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. Be sure to follow us on our Facebook page, Art Ladders, The Creative Climb with Valerie Allen and Armin Mersman. Special thanks to our producer, Taylor Kramer of Cold Shower Media.
And check out our websites, valerieallenart.com, arminmersman.com. Stay creative, stay curious, and we'll see you next time.